Welcome to Strategy Talk, where the contributors to strategypage.com discuss news as history and give you a unique view of events around the world. I'm Dan Masterson, publisher of strategypage.com, and your host. We'll be talking to Jim Duddigan, well-known military analyst, author, and editor of strategypage.com, and Austin Bay, author, columnist, and blogger. His blog can be found at austinbay.net. Jim and Austin have just finished the fourth edition of A Quick and Dirty Guide to War. So Jim and Austin, China is still sitting out there after the Olympics, and they're doing what China does, which is apparently right now building up their forces. Is that correct?
Well, they're building up their forces, but they have an enormous way to go. A couple of key things you have to remember about the Chinese. They haven't been militarily effective for centuries. That's an important point to remember. They lost a lot of people in Korea. They were slaughtered. I mean, Mao Zedong lost his son in Korea. You know, nobody's got an exact number because the Chinese have never released them. But it's alleged to be over 500,000. When I was in the service back in the 60s, a lot of my NCOs had served in Korea. They fought there, and they, to a man, you know, the thing I remember is they all commented, the Chinese were brave, but not all that bright. I mean, not stupid, but just not well-trained. It was like they were following orders. And years later, when I read about how the Chinese operated, they basically operated under a command system, which we associate with the Russians, but basically the Chinese invented. I mean, they've had this for thousands of years. You know, you follow orders, you know, unquestioningly, and which is very good, you know, in a military situation. But the way they were doing it against us, you know, just got them slaughtered. That has not changed. The second thing you have to keep in mind is a Chinese army has never done well in the opening stages of war. Now, you can say that about everybody, but for the Chinese, they tend to fail in a spectacular fashion in the opening stages of a war. They're like the Russians in that respect. The United States, Western armies used to do that, but not so much anymore because we have these professional armies which tend to overcome a lot of that natural problem of basically getting soft in peacetime. The other thing, and this is important and much hidden by the Chinese and simply ignored by everybody else, an enormous amount of corruption in the Chinese military. Now, that's nothing unique to the Chinese. Some of the oldest written records that have come down to us talk about corruption in military procurement and in the running of the military in general. It's so easy to tell the king, yeah, you've got 1,000 men on the payroll, but you've only got 900, 800 or whatever, and you're pocketing the rest of the money. I mean, that's the oldest scam, you know, known as far as historians can tell, or one of the oldest. The Chinese military has serious problems with the corruption. They don't like to talk about it. They don't even like to bring up the fact that they're fighting it. But it comes out usually, you know, a year or two or 5 or 10 in some cases later, that some of the fiascos they've had in acquiring new equipment, whether it be tanks or aircraft or underwear, you name it, there was somebody skimming big time, you know, in the background there. And it wasn't just the low bidder who got the contract. It was the guy who could basically supply the shoddiest crap, you know, manufactured for the lowest cost so everybody could, you know, line their pockets with most of the money allocated for the purchase. With all these problems, it's amazing that they are actually creating, in effect, an army within an army. They are creating a modern army with modern equipment, modern training methods. That is basically a fraction, maybe 10-20% of their armed forces, which is 2 million and falling, you know, personnel. And they are doing that because they understand what their problems are. And they're trying to overcome them by creating this army within an army. But when you realize that, you understand that you can never refer to the Chinese military as the largest in the world, which technically they are, with 2 million people under arms. They're one of the smallest because they only have 200,000 that are basically in the modern Chinese army. The traditional Chinese army, which is equipped and trained, you know, about 3 or 4 decades, you know, behind us, which is not too shabby if you're fighting an army, you know, U.S. Army from the 1960s. But these guys are, you know, good for disaster relief, as an employment program, which they don't need so much anymore because they're developing a bit of a labor shortage. And that's why they're shrinking the military overall. But because of all of this, the reporting about the Chinese military is grossly distorted. I mean, in other words, most of what most people get, you know, is not true. It's not a lie, but it's just journalists recycling the same old conventional wisdom, and you don't want to entrust your life with conventional wisdom. So there's the truth behind the Chinese military. Can I go home now?
Yeah. Well, Austin?
Let me comment on a couple of things here.
Okay.
All right. First of all, Jim's point about Chinese corruption, Chinese military corruption, one of the largest investors, and you can put that in italics, or Chinese army officers and some of these wholly owned corporations, because as Jim will point out, that the Chinese military owns companies. In Shanghai, and in Shanghai real estate in the 1990s was the Chinese army, and there were stories. They weren't stories. Fiction. They were the truth. They invested in nightclubs, hotels, restaurants, grocery stores, and the like. And this was part of the. As Jim said, there's a skimming going on. Is that it was legal for them to quote unquote invest in it? But the folks at the top were literally taking the cream off the top. It's going into many senior officers' pockets. Now, the Chinese began in, Jim, I think it was around 2000, wasn't it? The first of their attempted series of anti-corruption drives within the military?
Yes, and they ordered the generals to divest themselves of most of their companies.
It was roughly, I said 2000, maybe it had been 1999, 2000. The way these Chinese
started talking.
The Chinese move underneath before they announce it as well. And according to our sources, some of the Chinese officers did this, and some of them did not. And those that did not were eventually, many of them moved out of their billets. It has, in other words, the big point on this is it's been, at a corrupt level, a major player in the expansion of the Chinese economy and some of the major eastern cities. Second point, the Chinese military, the PLA and the Navy constantly look. Everybody thinks they're always looking at Taiwan. They're also looking at Japan, and because they are impressed with the level of competence that the very small but well equipped and really elite Japanese forces have. And when Jim talks about building this better army within the army, it's by no means at a Japanese self-defense forces army level, but nevertheless, I think that there is some thinking going on in China saying, look how mobile this particular force is, how technologically adept, and adding to that, here's the other point, like the Vietnamese, the Japanese, and let's not forget the Mongols, but the Vietnamese and Japanese are our old enemies, our traditional enemies. And this is speculation, but it's speculation founded on with some reason of saying that is a model of a force that if the Japanese can do it, we can do it.
Last, they admire a lot is Singapore.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
And which has possibly man for man, the best military forces in East Asia. And what impresses the Chinese is that the Singaporeans are Chinese.
And it's Chinese. It is a English speaking Chinese Buddhist island in a Muslim world. It's not just Buddhist. I shouldn't say that. There's actually a substantial East Indian community there on Singapore. Singapore is a...
And they're run under an authoritarian government, even though it's a democracy.
It's run under a colonial government, Jim.
Authoritarian.
They're running a British colonial government for themselves. I mean,
they basically said, hey, this works, why get rid of it?
That's
we'll just elect the governor general.
That sounds cheeky, but there's some truth to that. And having been to Singapore and talked to many people in the various Singaporean private and public sector, there's a little grin on their face when you point that up. But they say, look, remember the caning incident that happened a few years ago where they caned a British tourist who did something. They say, hey, wait a minute, that's just old British colonial law. We didn't get rid of it. And that's a small anecdote, but it's also a telling anecdote. Now, what I was going to say is that when he passes back to Jim, one of the issues that crops up the most in major media outside of Taiwan is Chinese Navy incidents involving the Chinese Navy, Chinese submarine popping up near an American carrier in an exercise and the like. Jim, you write frequently about China's attempts to create something larger than and better than a brown water navy. I'm going to ask you this. We know that the Spratlys are up for grabs. Is that really where they're headed, into the South China Sea instead of across the Taiwan Strait?
Well, they have more. They're more likely to gain something by hanging onto the Paracel and the Spratlys, those islands in the South China Sea, than they are in taking Taiwan, because the United States is not getting involved in the squabbles over what are basically rocks, and tiny islands in these shallow seas, between China and the Philippines and Indonesia. And they have used their naval power, but it, as you point out, it's basically a coastal power. They haven't really demonstrated the ability to operate for a long time, any longer than a few days at a stretch, on the high seas. So they are still basically a coastal army, and as far as they're concerned, all those little islands down there in the South China Sea are coastal, shallow water. We can go out there, and they fought some naval battles, which you never hear about. I mean, they were not big battles. But in the last 30 or so years, there have been some skirmishes, I guess we call them, but they won. And they now have bases. In fact, we just reported that they expanded a base on one of those islands so it can handle their Su-30 fighters. They put in more fuel tanks and what have you. But they consider that more a business investment than a military operation, because they believe that oil will be found out there, or there's always the fish.
And that's their big thing, right? Is that they've got to find more oil just because of what is happening in their economy.
Yes, because when the oil price spiked at $140 not too long ago, the Chinese, and even though the Chinese raised the price of oil, of gasoline in their country, oil demand didn't go down that much, which is kind of scary, because even with a fairly hyper economy, which they've had going for the last couple of decades, and a huge spike in oil demand, and far more people out there driving cars, but there were so many more people out there driving trucks and construction equipment, and they just said, hey, we'll pay for it. That big problem is oil. Although in the last couple of months, there's been a huge shrinkage in the amount of raw materials that Chinese firms have been importing. In other words, they're planning for a worldwide recession, and they've canceled a lot of orders, and a lot of ships are sitting around empty, not picking up stuff in Australia, in South America, and what have you, and shipping it off to China. This has just happened over the last month or so. But that just shows that, when it comes to business, they're at the top of the game. Of course, the British always said that during the colonial period, be careful when you do business with a Chinaman, because they may not be able to fight, but boy, they can wheel and deal.
Right. Well, the one thing that we as Westerners forget is the Chinese, and this comes from some of my own business dealings, is they think long term. They don't care if something happens tomorrow. They think long term.
Yes, and that is part of their culture, and that is a huge advantage in business, because in the long term, that's where big things happen. Short term, it's just nuisances.
Austin?
Yes, sir.
We talked about Africa last week, and China has been injecting themselves into Africa. Is it mainly because they want to get to oil resources, or do they have some other motivation for getting involved in Africa?
It's resources in general. Oil is the primary reason. And in Sudan, but Africa, it is, back up just for a moment, some of the charges you see being aimed at China now from, African countries and also some of the nonprofit organizations operating in Africa is that about Chinese economic imperialism or Chinese resource imperialism. For example, the deal they made with Congo, which is very controversial within Congo, China is willing to trade building infrastructure. And there's some things about this that are a good deal for Congo. China's going to build roads, including also power infrastructure, but China wants to build it towards some of these mines. And I'm doing this from memory, but I believe that cobalt and copper are a couple of the minerals of interest, of their particular interest. Of course, though they're both found in Congo, and they want access to the mineral resources, so they're going to make a trade on supplying engineering, labor, and you know, some buying some local materials. But there's the issue with the Chinese is that they like to bring their own workers in, see, and that's their international cadre to do the work. And there are the Congolese that object to this deal that the Congolese government has made. Is that we want those work jobs ourselves. So in my view, the primary reason is economic access to resources. I think China also understands the way the General Assembly works in the United Nations. Well, the action tends to be in the Security Council. They also see that you'll see that playing to some of the countries in the General Assembly has a long-term diplomatic payoff, so they want to show some interest at the diplomatic political level. And again, I think that's also looking out a decade or two decades and what they may or may not be interested in doing globally. I don't see it as in any kind of Cold War context, is that, i.e., we're trying to grab bases or, as a matter of fact, what I've seen out of the Chinese is that, yeah, they'll sell you weapons, but at the same time, they're more interested in stable trading relationships. So, yeah, I'd be interested to hear what Jim has to say about that.
It's mainly economic. They see Africa as a place where there's business to be done, and the Chinese aren't adverse to taking chances. Again, they don't have the PC, the politically correct hang-ups that Western governments have, so they're willing to deal with the devil as long as the devil, you know, has cash or, you know, raw materials that they need. So that more flexible morality gives them a big advantage. And that's what ticks off a lot of, you know, Western firms, because there's a number of Western firms that have just the same buccaneer spirit that the Chinese do, but, you know, have political and public relations problems back home that limit their ability to go rampaging, you know, through Africa. Indeed, a lot of the companies or the resources that the Chinese are getting into, you know, old mines and what have you, were originally, you know, founded by Western buccaneers, you know, British colonialists, you know, French entrepreneurs in Africa. The Belgians have the bloodiest reputation. But that's, again, that's no longer PC. Companies have to worry about their public image in the West. The Chinese took one look at that and saw opportunity, and they're just taking advantage of it.
Now, Jim, one of the things is my favorite topic about China is their cyber forces. And actually, it's one of the scariest, and we've written a lot about it on Strategy Page. But my assumption is that they're continuing to develop their ability to do cyber espionage and look at bringing down economies and like that.
Two things to remember about that. One, most of their technology is from the West. You know, the code, for example, the Golden Wall or the Great Firewall of China that tries to control the Internet as well as even the cell phone, which is a huge, larger infrastructure than even the Internet. They buy security technology created in the West for corporations to control their workers from doing something that, you know, is going to get them sued for hurting somebody's feelings. They buy that from the West, and then they make modifications. They have a lot of skilled programmers, but most of them are doing legit work. The really dodgy, you know, hacking, as it were, is apparently being done not by anybody on the Chinese government payroll, but by criminals or contractors, you know, in the malign sense. In other words, guys who are arguably criminals but are trying to operate, you know, in a quasi-legal fashion, for whatever reason. They use a lot of these freelancers to go and do a lot of the snooping around. I mean, that's what I've been hearing from D.C. people I know in that area down there. They tell me that while you can trace a lot of the hacking, the, you know, the probing into American government and military networks back to China, they rarely find that it's a Chinese government organization that's actually doing it. It's somebody near the Chinese government, but they're basically the same guys who are sending spam or are doing industrial espionage. Indeed, a story that'll probably pop up in the mainstream media before too long is that there is a organization, I haven't been given a name, even a code word, but in China, that basically specializes in industrial espionage. They're very proficient. They apparently have a lot of clients, and you know, busting open who these people are is like, you know, arresting the madame of a high class brothel. In other words, it could be very embarrassing for some organizations. But apparently there has been somebody who's been very successful in doing industrial espionage, mostly in corporations, but also in governments, because governments often hold, you know, economically exploitable secrets. So that's a story that may break, you know, in the next year. But those are the hints that people, you know, our cyber, you know, security people are getting. I mean, I've heard basically that sort of stuff down at Wall Street, where there are a lot of, where some of the best cybersecurity is, but they will also work with people in the government as consultants and what have you, or just talking shop, because they're basically in the front line of some of the best hackers in the world, because Wall Street's where the money is, or a lot of it used to be. But the Chinese are apparently not cyber supermen themselves, but have access to people who are, and they're using them.
Hmm. That's interesting.
Dan, I was just going to add something, and Jim actually brought back to it. The Chinese complain about U.S. penetrations, too. So,
well, there are, because there are a lot of skilled animals. You got to remember, most of the Internet hacking talent is in the United States, and most of the rest of it is in Europe. A lot of it in Eastern Europe.
That's because we have too many 16- and 17-year-olds that don't need jobs that get to sit around all day and play
with
stuff.
That's true. I mean, that's very true. That's why America had an advantage, too, in that most of the American troops knew how to drive, which was unusual. Nobody thought anything of it until after the war, and then somebody looked at the prisoner of war interviews and said, gee, most of these guys couldn't drive. I wonder why that is. I mean, again, you can be blind to this kind of stuff, but most kids in the military today, or most kids, period, have grown up with electronic devices, and a lot of them get into programming, and then once you get into programming, it, as Dan well knows, because he's got a couple of them, you know, of his own, quickly become very expert at this stuff, expert and dangerous, or, you know, just annoying. But a lot of the hacking exploits, you know, that get spread all over the media are just some, as Dan points out, some 16-year-old kid with too much time on his hand and half a brain. And you put something like that in front of a computer, mischief will ensue, not necessarily mirth. And that's what's happening in the United States, attacks on China, because you get on the internet neighborhood, as it were, a lot of these chat rooms in obscure areas, you know, not even the internet, news groups, you get a lot of flame wars going, and before long you get the cyber equivalent of a barroom brawl. And what these guys, and often it goes beyond defacing each other's pages. A lot of times, you know, I'll show you how tough I am. And before you know it, somebody's, you know, noticing around inside the interior in China, you know, his databases. Fortunately, in most of these cases, the kid doesn't understand, you know how to read Chinese. So he gets bored looking for English language stuff, which is probably usually stuff stolen from some corporation or from the United States, and just goes away. But he leaves, you know, the Chinese, you know, sysadmins in a cold sweat. Especially when they find out the guy who did it was just nosing around, wasn't really up to anything, you know, of particular, you know, military or diplomatic worth. And if a mere kid from your major opponent can do this, you know, what if the Americans get serious? This is something, again, Americans don't realize. The military and governmental officials and a lot of our potential enemies fear us a lot more than we realize. They look at American technology. They look at American capabilities. And they look at them, you know, from somebody who is potentially on the receiving end, not just somebody who takes it for granted. And they are scared. A lot of this came out, again, it wasn't noticed in the United States, even though it was reported, but after the Cold War, and the experts from both sides could talk freely, and I saw it even in the New York Times, you know, Russians saying, you know, we were terrified of this and terrified of that. Most Americans just went right past them. So isn't that cute? But in wartime, or in pre-war time, as it were, it's a powerful weapon. And
right.
I'm telling you right now, the Chinese are afraid of us more than we are afraid of them.
One of the things, Dan, that the United States does not give itself credit for, because it's far easier to complain, point fingers, and there's all the political, domestic political scrabbling goes on in the United States, is the United States' extraordinary flexibility and adaptability. And the system, you know, we talk about, oh, it doesn't respond, it's failed this, it's failed that. But one measure of comparison is the way the Japanese did not directly address their asset bubble in the early 1990s. And the way, as floundering as it is, and it appears, the United States in its is going about its addressing the issue of the asset bubble, meaning the real estate asset bubble, and taking it on head on. Notice, too, that even Western Europe, as sophisticated and wealthy as Western Europe is, Western Europe follows the United States lead in addressing the asset bubble. Now, we sit back and say, oh, well, that's because the United States is the world's biggest economy. Aha. Uh-huh. But it's also the world's biggest economy, that a huge economy that is extraordinarily flexible. We can indict the U.S. for looking at quarterly or yearly basis instead of the long term, as we were praising the Chinese earlier. But at the same time, the United States has a, what our opponents or our potential opponents or even our allies sit back and say, well, that's really extraordinary what the United States has done.
Yeah, something else you have to keep in mind, too, is that the rate of change, new technology, and just change in general, has turned the short term into what used to be the long term. In other words, things didn't change that much. You can plan the long term.
It's a huge point, and it's a point that in some ways mitigates, I don't say that it completely absolves, but mitigates the U.S. tendency to look at much shorter term, because of the, as Jim points out, the turnaround in technology is extraordinarily fast.
Yeah, and then also another thing that gets overlooked is that we ignore our successes because good news isn't news, and we concentrate on the bad news. But as anybody down on Wall Street will tell you, he says enormous amounts of money were made legitimately, you know, in the last 20, 30 years because of the revolution in, you know, the technique that has been developed on Wall Street and to a lesser extent in London and in Tokyo. But all this financial mumbo-jumbo, which understandably most people don't even understand. But those who do and who are not necessarily in the middle of it in Wall Street, but just can understand it enough to stand back and say, oh, I see what's going on. And that's interesting. That's admirable. But, you know, you only pay attention to them when they stumble. If you look at some simple things like how many recessions there have been, how deep they have been, the recessions have been fewer and shallower over the last 40 years, and that has nothing to do with the government.
That's right.
All the new technology in Wall Street, you know, the things that are running the economy. So don't throw the baby out with the bathwater when you start, you know, reforming.
That is definitely correct, and our I think our private industry and enterprise is where China and other people would like to emulate more and are looking at. And I think that's a good place to end it.
Okay, next week. Bye-bye.
All right, we'll see you.
Bye-bye, guys.